Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, audience, to the One Cell, One Light radio show with your host, Dr. Hildegard Stanninger, commonly known as Dr. Hildy. And today's guest, before I introduce him, I want you to know I've known him for close to 20 years. He's a leading scientist in the realms of what he specializes in. And today's show is especially for you, audience, to learn not something new, but the new terms, because it's been here from the existence of time, I personally feel. And it's on the epigenetics, a new approach to disease intervention and prevention. But before I introduce my guest, I want to read something which I've asked him with permission, and he allowed this. And this is a quote from Abraham Hicks, and it's on our site. There is a lot of technical papers on the site in reference to this show, so please read them, enjoy them, and reference them. We would appreciate that. As you are born into these physical bodies, you experience the vibrational continuum of the generations that have come before you, their desires as they have lived as individuals, and their collective mass consciousness desire as emanated to the boundary, less boundaries of the universe, and law of attraction is answering all of those requests. So each generation who follow the previous generation benefits by the desires that have been executed by mass consciousness. And I want to introduce to you, audience, and to those wonderful 120 countries that listen to us, thank you, and happy holidays to all of you, Mr. George Morse. Welcome to the show, George.
Thank you, Dr. Hildy. I'm glad to be on it.
You're welcome. And as I shared with the audience, we've known each other close to 20 years, two decades.
And, yeah, it has been.
And I'm very proud to have him on my show. I've asked him several times in the past, and he's always been so busy. And today, on this special day, which is also a full moon eclipse, the second eclipse in this month, which is a full moon eclipse, but over a black hole. So we're going to suck all that non-truthfulness out and put the truth there. Right, George?
We're going to try.
I know. Well, you know me. I just keep on going, you know. I know because George was, in the very beginning when we first met, brought to the great state of Florida, the first shamatsu, and highly trained in high-pressure liquid chromatography. This is, you know, 20 years ago, right at the peak of that type of technology. And he is a trained chemist. But tell the audience, George, why you got involved into prevention and the wellness of individuals.
I guess myself, like most people, we get involved in things because that's what fate brings us. When I was a child, I was just exposed to a lot of pesticides and herbicides because of spraying that we did. And those things ended up causing me really severe migraine headaches. And I was very fortunate. I got to meet Dr. John R. Christopher, the developer of Christopher Herbs. And he basically brought herbal products into the health food industry.
Yes, he did. And he was the leader of that.
He was the initiator. Everything followed from him. And so, fortunately, the town that I was living in, he came through there a couple of years in a row, providing seminars to us. And basically, he taught me that energy in herbs can be used to go ahead and heal. And he also basically taught me that, as far as he was concerned, there were no incurable people. That if a person was doing the right thing, they could be cured.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as you said, I was a chemist. I was initially involved in laboratory analysis where we were focused on helping people identify disease early
mm-hmm.
so that
right.
They could go ahead and have treatment. And then that later shifted to my researching and looking at testing that can answer in the shortest possible time the question, is the intervention working?
Right, and those types of tests that were developed early on that are now used as, I'm going to call it standard tests for diagnostics, in the early years, we're talking 20 years back or even earlier, because you've been a chemist even before we met professionally, the thing is that these tests, basically, the biological monitoring test, I have always felt, should be the guidelines to show exposure or the reaction to the microorganism or whatever may be going on in the body. But if you use those markers, and just as you said, George, if the treatment, the therapy is working, these markers should be changing to read within the normals. And the normals are, by testing, can be the clinical reference of so many samples versus the true normal. It's not normal to have lead in your blood, as I say, because it's not in the composition of blood. It may be a contaminant of the blood.
It's like if the way that the industry was developed. Testing was developed to go ahead and identify and help to promote the basic premise of medicine, which is that we need to go ahead and treat you if you have something that's wrong. It wasn't designed to go ahead and look at what we would say is early disease, because that definition of early disease doesn't exist in clinical. Either you are diseased or you're not. And so in order for them to treat something, they have to have you in that disease state. And so when you go ahead and say, oh, I'm going to do testing that's going to look for people before they've got those manifestation of symptoms, they say that doesn't do us any good. And
right.
a perfect example was that in the 70s, they came out with testing that could identify breast cancer early, more effectively than an EKG could identify a heart attack early. And yet after 2 years of the manufacturer trying to promote it, he took the test kit off the market because nobody would use it.
Right.
Because nobody wanted to go ahead and identify a potential that couldn't be defined as a disease because insurance wouldn't, they couldn't get covered for it.
Right, and a lot of times, audience, what we're talking in the initiation in science, they say, what is the etiology? Where did the disease come from, et cetera? And these are the precursors that as scientists or ones who have studied a lot of physiology and looking at these types of markers can identify. I know you were instrumental in my early work with the Maverick compounds, where those were 23 compounds that were looking at enzymes and all their other chemicals that came out of the cell during cellular degradation that could initiate a disease pattern, whether it was ovarian cancer or just cell death, or whatever it may be, but it's these markers that can be used to identify, one, what your level and time is at that state of time, the date on the calendar, and then, as you said, for that intervention of what is going on so you can turn it around. So your body can start to heal itself with the right nutrients and the right support that is needed. And the sensitivity, I would appreciate it, George, if you would bring out to the audience, because you and I both love history and have seen how science and history has changed within our lifetime, as within our parents and grandparents. But in laboratory, because you were first in the beginning of early disease detection, and then looking at, like what you did with Alpha Diagnostics Research, in looking at what is early detection, if you could give an ideal or explain to the audience what you mean by early detection. Or even the size.
When you look at the development of disease, what you have to do is you just have to think of it as a chain reaction. And it's one thing that slightly modifies and becomes another thing, becomes slightly modified, becomes another thing. And there may be 100 links in this chain that go from, let's say, a pesticide exposure to having cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the whole system looks at it is that unless that chain in the link can be actually defined as the disease, they don't want to know about it. Whereas patients, people that are interested in their health, they want to go back that chain as far as they can, because the farther back on that chain of development of disease that you can start, and you can create and you can interact with it, and you can go ahead and start to modify it and break that chain, the easier it is for your body to overcome it. And that is basically where we're at right now, is that science went ahead and more recently has gone ahead and said that some of the things that we've taught in the past are actually real, that they can validate them. And so that's what we're talking about today, is the fact that sometime for the past 20 years, the same things are the interactions and the interventions that we've wanted to do.
Right.
It's just that now we actually have science coming on our side and saying that, yes, it should work.
Right, and it's due to those sensitivities of detection that are available now. When I just introduced you, I'm bringing the Shimatsu, the high-pressure liquid chromatography technology into Florida. That technology was wonderful if we could get into parts per trillion, and if you were an extra good chromatographer and could really play with that column to make it even go more into parts per trillion, it was beyond excellence then. But now with nanotechnology, you can go down to 9 decimals. You can see, as I've shared with Dr. Shingla when he was on, inject a stem cell with a fluorescent dye, and as the stem cell divides and makes the daughter cells, you have dye in them. So it shows that the one is the chemicals going with the development of the cells, thus meaning maybe generational exposures over time, But the sensitivity that is available in the science community for analytical, and even the advent of Raman technology and the application of it commercially, it's just phenomenal that we can start to prove. We're seeing really how even the area of homeopathy, meaning it was a dilution of a dilution of a dilution and beyond, but it did have a common source back to that mineral or back to that compound that was used to make that homeopathic agent. Science is proving that now.
I think your original question to me was just on can I relate to what that improvement in science has been. And when I left environmental, that massive change had happened. All of this technology had come in for environmental to go ahead and be able to identify pollution, to be able to go ahead and do all of these things that, that instrumentation could do. And when I left environmental and went into clinical at that time in 96, I saw that in clinical, they were using none of it.
Right.
When you would go ahead and do a separation, it's called electrophoresis. You're going ahead and use an electrical charge to separate the components of your blood and to look at them. And if you were in environmental and you were looking at that, you'd be looking at it with a piece of software that would go ahead and break it down into, maybe 1,000 little steps, and it would go ahead and it would tell you what was the intensity of every single one of those little steps, and then you would have a software program that would help you understand the significance of it. When you get to clinical, the person was doing the electrophoresis, they were staining it, and then they were looking at it by their eye. They didn't even have instrumentation to use to go ahead and look at it. And that was because they didn't believe there was a value. And so what we've done is you have everybody changing what they felt was a value, and the only thing that is of value is the identification of disease, not the ability to detect it. And that was what I saw when I first got into clinical in 96. And so that's what I went ahead, as you said, with Alpha Diagnostic Research. We went ahead and we looked at ways to try to gain a lot more information from doing the similar or improved test.
Right. And,
that's what I've been doing ever since.
And with you professionally coming not only as a chemist, but also in the environment, because we always, all of us basically cross paths, started in environmental or in industry as industrial hygienist or any of that, meaning we knew the importance of analytical because, like in the environmental, you wanted to make sure that those underground water wells were not polluted or polluted and how to clean them up versus in industry, you didn't want the employee exposed to these toxic fumes or mist in their breathing zone while they were working and producing equipment or different products. And I'm very happy that you're here with us, George, especially today, and because you can share this information, and probably that might be why you consented to being on the radio program, because I know it's close to your heart and seeing people well and overcoming their illnesses by having the right knowledge to not only prevent it, but also to take that knowledge and apply it to their own well-being.
I know at one point you were interested, but you know, as why I chose to go ahead and do this, and it's really it's because I've tried everything else.
And that's a good reason.
For 15 years, I've gone ahead and I've gotten together with laboratories, I've gotten together with physicians, I've gotten together with physician groups, I've gotten together with alternative physicians, I've gotten together with alternative physician groups, I've gotten together with natural products people. As I said, I communicated with, you name it, with the FDA, trying to convince them that there was, you know, better testing for toxicity determination than anything they were using, and it's just right off the shelf. They just don't want to use it.
Yeah, even the AMA.
To talking with all the politicians that I could ever talk to and send letters to. And it comes down to this. Everybody is pretty well satisfied with the status quo.
Right. And I know it can be frustrating because I know myself where you and I see it basically is there's a lot of chemicals out there that can do the same type of pathological effects within the body that people aren't even looking at. Or if you have an elevated level, we'll just say ammonia, they have no idea to look at the amino acids or anything to help those individuals, you know. But it gets very frustrating. I know what you're talking about that way.
I mean, every year more than 2 million Americans have serious side effects from prescription drugs, and close to 100,000 of them die.
Right, and you know what gets me furious is that these prescription drugs, okay, you're using them, but why aren't you checking to see if it's bioaccumulating in the body and just causing a systemic toxicity because it just can't be broken down by the body in some cases, especially if they're really a disease state, you know, where they're not absorbing nutrients right and thus not absorbing the medication?
I sent multiple letters to the FDA. I finally got one of the researchers to contact me back, basically because I was talking about liver toxicity, and which is one of the primary things that the drugs cause and one of the primary reasons people die.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that, oh, yes, well, we see that this is an analysis method, and, you know, it does have some value, but it's not within our scope of work. We're only interested in identifying those people that are going to have a death or near-death experience from the drug, because everything else they classify as an acceptable outcome. And it all comes down to what I've called that, you know, there is this overriding thing of that there's profit in disease care.
Yeah.
And hopefully somehow within this period of time, we're going to be able to go ahead and provide to people an understanding that they don't have to be stuck in that system.
Right.
Even though there's the globalization of their processed foods, there's the denitrification of fresh produce to improve shelf life. There's complete restrictions on herbal information and even on personal responsibility for their own health care. Those are things that we cannot actually change, but we can change what we're doing.
Right, and basically that's like if an individual doesn't take responsibility and the control of their own health, they have lost the control of their health through the system, and thus in doing that, you end up with a loss of personal wellness.
As I've told you before, you know, we've gone ahead and science is good, but the science of the 20th century really got involved in a quest for profits for the pharmaceutical industry. And so in that quest for profits, they were looking at ways to go ahead and promote disease care, because those are the people that needed their services the most. And so in the 20th century, they went ahead and they looked for these things, because they looked at things that were fit their definition of what they wanted. They were able to go ahead and self-fulfill their prophecy of saying that what they were doing was right. Now, here in the 21st century, we've got this mounting health care cost, and we've got new information that supports this process that we call of intervention called epigenetics modification.
Mm-hmm.
Now, science and the public, it's like that financial component that forced healthcare away from people is now going to go ahead and actually give control of wellness back, because the system that we have is just out of control. There's no way that we can just continue having the same number of diseased people and trying to treat them. We have to stop and reduce down the disease burden in society, and that takes personal responsibility, because the politicians, the for-profit people are this not able to go ahead and do it.
Right, and it's as simple as this. I've had a wonderful couple come into my office at one time a couple weeks ago, and they looked at me and said, "Dr. Hilde, oh, we don't buy this that we only have to live to be 100 or that. We're going to be around here until we're 200 years old, and we're looking at all different alternative therapies, and that's so that we can increase the longevity of our genes so that it can stimulate and make the right metabolic processes within our body." And I thought that was wonderful. I thought that was a fantastic outlook on life and how they were taking control of their own bodies, of their temples, and addressing it that way. And George, you know, from the history of treating disease, I mean, we can't go back to the beginning of the Phoenicians and the Babylonians and all of that, but I'm going to bring it forward. We're going to start, audience, like in the 1900s, because epigenetics is the new buzzword, okay? It's been around from the beginning of time, as I call it, because we're all human. We started from our initial ancestors a long time ago. And but just looking from the 1900s, we're going, 1900s is 45 years after the Civil War. So you can get the time frame. 1917 was World War One. 1930s was World War Two. You know, so what I'm saying is, so you can get the timeline in your mind so you can see the different advents of what was going on. But we're focusing it, and I'd like George to begin the conversation that way, focusing it around the concept of genetics. We do know, the audience has heard Ms. Annie Choi and I discuss our study of showing why Koreans had Roman feet versus Egyptian, and we found that the Romans went to the Himalayans. They must have went down into Korea or sailed around that area, because we're doing the taste test for phenylthiourea, George.
Mm-hmm.
And sodium benzoate, because they're dominant. You're either, you taste it or you don't taste it, or with sodium, that's the phenylthiourea, and it can be the buildup of the thiols and the mercaptans. And which is interesting, I've went back and read all my Maverick stuff, is those thiols and the mercaptans love to stay inside the cell, and that's a whole other story in future research. But what we learned from that simple study, that in 1931 was that first little paper looking at the difference of a simple test, and that was with Dr. Fox, who now is identified with the Fox genes. But keep that in mind, 1931, but we're going to start with 1900s, right, George?
Yeah, well, 1900s was basically when the science of genetics was started. There were people looking at trying to understand, you know, where did we come from, how did things progress. And by 1910, science actually identified that there are genes that are carried around in our blood that are the transporters of heredity.
Mm-hmm.
And then by 1930s, Darwin's book, The Theory of Natural Selection, actually was made public. And so here you have this additional science, all this information that got provided and on how natural selection and how we went ahead and evolved was put into the public sphere. It wasn't strictly to scientists anymore. And then by you get up to the 1950s, science had actually identified the very first purely genetic disease, a disease that was passed on from parents to children, and that was sickle cell anemia. Then later in 1953, they went ahead and they actually defined what the structure of DNA was. And now you've got all of the science looking at genetics. And so by the time it gets to be 1971, you get the National Cancer Act, and it goes ahead and basically says that we're going to spend tons and tons and tons of money to try to understand how all cancer is basically genetic. And
I would like to add that, but I have found that not only genetic, but when you have that combination of virus and chemicals, that brings out a whole other possibility. And that's why I purposely linked for this show, George, the paper that I did with Scott Evans years ago on the first genetic mutations is caused from contaminated groundwater. Because
yeah, you did that in 84, I believe.
Yeah, and it gives beautiful combinations in our outlines of what's happening. What the amazing thing of Scott Evans and I said years ago, we're amazed at how accurate and everything was back down in 1983, and now it's being proven what we said back in 1983 beyond ourselves.
That's basically what the science is doing. As we said, what we're doing isn't necessarily new, but it's going ahead and being able to actually, instead of this theoretical, there's this more and more actual scientific proof showing what we're doing, what we're talking about works.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happened was, so now you got, we're up to the, say maybe the year 2000, you've got the development of the sequencing of the human genome, the whole White House ceremony. It was supposed to go ahead and bring in, and usher in this whole new era for targeted therapy.
Right, which is the gene therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
That,
Gleevec
was
the first
therapy?
One of that type of cancer drug. And it basically was designed to go ahead and interact with an enzyme specific that was being specifically overactive in that specific cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a new type of chemotherapy that they developed.
Right. And just looking at that, the statement, overactive enzyme, how do we know, meaning from our sciences and working with analytical all the time, I could stimulate into my mind, well, maybe this person has a metabolic pathway that's either obstructed or changed or had to be made a new pathway by the liver because of what they could have been contaminated with. Because we've seen ourselves, as just using malathion as an example or diazinon, how acetylcholinesterase enzymes can go sky high. And even more, I've seen them rocket, like going out into the atmosphere when it's exposed to nanoparticles or nanomaterials. It just amplifies that enzyme even more. I'm talking instead of going from 6,000 to 10,000, it goes to like 16,000, 15,000, extremely high.
That was the discovery that they made was
mm-hmm.
the fact that they could go ahead and they link back to a specific gene mutation the control of that manufacturer of that enzyme that was deficient.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what this drug did was it went ahead and substituted for the gene ability to go ahead and manufacture this enzyme to going ahead and manufacturing it for them. And so
right.
Now you have a drug that does not actually generate a cure. It creates a modification that has to be modified the rest of the person's life.
Right, and I've always found it very interesting. This is a little off track, but not totally. Chemotherapy agents, a majority of them, were made from the mycotoxins of molds, fungi, and because then they could formulate them synthetically, audience, meaning, through pharmaceutical methods or however they were synthesized, but then they could register a chemical abstract number with the American Chemical Society because then it could always be made the same way, as being synthesized. But I always found
mm-hmm.
it very interesting that they used mycotoxins, and a lot of we who have been knowledgeable or had to clean up mold or any of that type of thing knows the toxicity of it, but it's like the medical side goes, okay, this chemical is great for chemotherapy, and yes, it kills the good cells and the bad cells, but it's It's a Fusarium, I'm going to just use this as an example, a Fusarium mycotoxin, but we don't understand how Fusarium mycotoxin acts in the natural environment. I think it's very interesting.
I've created basically a philosophy that that I use to try to explain most things that the medical profession does.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the eliminate the bad principle. And basically, physicians, and let's say specifically to cancer, they believe in this eliminate the bad principle. And so they're going to go ahead and cut off the bad part. They're going to use a pharmaceutical to modify or destroy the bad part. They're going to use X-rays or radioactive isotopes to burn out the bad part. And it's all because they believe in this eliminate the bad principle.
Right.
And I think that's up on the web on one of my papers that's up there. It basically what the eliminate the bad principle is that if you have good plus bad, you eliminate the bad, you're left with good. There's a problem in this principle, though, because it's based on two unproven theories. First, they believe whatever they do to eliminate bad, if it does not immediately manifest a symptom as bad as the one they're trying to eliminate, it is good. Now, I don't believe that.
I don't either.
The second one is, if something is good, then providing both more of it and providing it for a longer period of time is also good. And it remains good up to the point of manifesting symptoms as bad as the one you're trying to eliminate. Therefore, when they're treating cancer, until the person dies from their therapy, they're doing good. And
because the end result of cancer would be death. That's what.
Right. Because they claim the result of cancer is going to be death. And so it doesn't matter how severe the side effect is, it's still not as bad as what they're trying to eliminate. And therefore, they go ahead and they can look for, as you said, basic toxins that are out in the environment that they can selectively use and say, well, yes, this toxin is really, really bad, but it does only kill off one type of tissue, and that's the tissue that this tumor is in. And so we can go ahead and we can give it the patient. The patient may go ahead and suffer some side effect, but we're being good.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the last part of it is they go ahead and say that, well, as long as we've gone ahead and continued life for 5 years, we are successful. And so now, as long as they can go ahead and they can give a person their chemotherapy drug or whatever it is that they're doing, and it interferes with that end-stage process for at least 5 years, the statistics of cancer treatment say that that was a success. Now, you take someone that's in their 50s, and they say that, well, if you make it to 55, now that was a success.
Right, or past those 5 years of waiting, you know, with some of the technologies of chemotherapy or any of those processes. Say if you make it past 5 years, you've licked the disease.
Well, or by their definition of being a success, they claim success. It doesn't matter if they've licked the disease or not. A lot of the ways they look at it, and another way to look at it is, how many people do you know that are taking drugs that after they've had them for a couple of years, they take a second drug for the symptoms that they got from the first one. They go ahead and they're taking that one now for a few years, and then they're going ahead and they're taking another drug for the symptoms that one created. And now you have this 50-year-old person that initially had maybe a cardiovascular problem, and now they got a medicine cabinet of six or eight things that they're taking. How has that helped?
Right, and the assimilation of it, as I stated earlier in the show, meaning you're taking so much of it, absorbing. And also, you brought out a very good point with Dr. John Christopher in the beginning of the show, George, where he said plants, herbs, in particular herbs that he addressed with you, have a life force, have energy, versus a lot of these medications have nothing. It's like 60 hertz, dead, Luciferian energy, you know?
There's a group of a portion of medicine called systemic medicine. And basically in it they go ahead and they kind of say like you're on a three-legged stool, and that's your health. And it doesn't matter what pharmaceutical you take. It may go ahead and help support one or two of the legs, but at least one of them is getting destroyed. And you go down, you can't recover. You can't get better unless your whole body gets better. It's not like, oh, wow, oh, my lungs are so much better, but I just died a heart attack. It doesn't work that way.
Right. And like we've seen with cancers, I know both of us knew Dr. Parsons when he was alive, James Monroe Parsons, and he loved the hyperbaric, was the first to bring it into the state, and he'd always say, you know, cancer, come from pathology, Hilda, you know, cancer is the starvation of oxygen within the cells, and people, you know, the more of that oxygen starvation from whatever is causing the cell to disassociate, not work properly, not work in harmony with the others. And even, meaning everyone can understand the importance of not putting a plastic bag over your head and suffocating. It just means that in these other areas where the oxygen is lacking, it's congested or it's blocked, that supply, into those areas. It could be in a portion of the liver, like the solid organs that you've brought out in some of your papers, like breast, lung, colon, and pancreas. You know, we've seen increases in these types of diseases just in the last 2 years.
And that's one of the reasons, well, you're finding more people that end up dying from those diseases is because the whole biotech philosophy of being able to go ahead and study genetics and have genetics go ahead and be able to help us in the treatment, it all failed.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they found out that, and that's what why epigenetics is so important, is because epigenetics basically was proven because of the failure of genetic disease to be proven. And so basically the more we science has understood of how the human genome does lead to go ahead and control life, the more we've gone ahead and understood that the genetic inheritance theory of disease applies to fewer and fewer diseases.
Right, and I'm gonna bring out, like, there's about four primary genetic diseases that have been just even isolated, you know, in the last 50 years or since 1993. Example, Tay-Sachs disease, Fragile X syndrome, and Down syndrome. And then in 1993, was Huntington disease. And they're still looking for the cure. But I'm just going to focus on two of them, George, with you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Like Down syndrome, which was usually associated with having mongoloid features, meaning Asiatic features, within a child. And the child was born of a woman that was 35 or years older, meaning an older woman giving birth, okay? That was the association in the 50s and
mm-hmm.
the 40s, okay? Versus when I was in aerospace, my whole job was reproductive hazard evaluation and pioneered that whole area years ago in industrial hygiene. The thing is, we knew that bisphenol A, which was used as a catalyst with epichlorohydrin to make plastics in microelectronics, individuals that were around that chemical, it caused a slower exchange of the genes so that you could be a male or a female. Not that it had to be female as in the 50s only, but male or female, and you would give birth at age 20, 21, versus, you know, older age having child, of a mongoloid, baby, meaning a Down syndrome child. The thing is, though, it was so now we talk about bisphenol A, BPA, which is on baby bottles, et cetera, now, and what is happening to the endocrine system. But back then, you had, you know, by back then, meaning in the 50s, you don't have it. The science is there showing the association with the chemicals, but it's where the genetic side's not looking at the chemicals on that disease. Versus, you know, before we move out of Down syndrome, do you have any comment?
You were just talking about what they thought in the 50s. And mm-hmm. basically what it is they, because they went ahead and they believed that these diseases were genetic, and that as they went ahead and would do more and more, you know, scientific breakthroughs, they would go ahead and they would be able to show and prove how these diseases were passed from parent to child. And so when they would go ahead and identify someone that, say, a relative that had a disease, and then they would go back to the other relatives, and they would go ahead, and the question wouldn't be, now, will you get it? But the statement to the poor family members was, when will you get it? And so basically they took prevention entirely out of the topic. Because they basically said, since it's in your genes, it's your fate. And until this day, basically 95% of all cancer dollars have all gone toward controlling that end-stage symptom. And barely 5% has gone through toward any form of prevention-type intervention.
Right. That's the whole thing, and where I'm coming from is no one's looking at the chemicals, and these chemicals can be small molecules on the genes or separations of, and cause the interaction. And I know science is going to prove that, and I hope you and I are part of that proof in creating that in the future. The other disease that was found, in this time frame that used to only affect South American countries, was what you brought out to me was Fragile X syndrome. This is basically, audience, a genetic disease that it causes disabilities of intellect, in particular in male children. And what happens is that these male children cannot, they grow up and they don't function behaviorally in, like they flap their hands, they have social anxiety, and in a physiological, they may be a single carrier, and they may have larger testicles. It was brought out in the, you know, in the literature. The thing is, though, knowing from my work of the cell, George, that the membrane of individuals that are of Hispanic nationalities, just as South America would be, but they would also have the Mesoamerican genes, that they had a thicker membrane, cellular membrane, thus more superoxide dismutase. And I find it interesting that this particular genetic disease, which when it's social anxiety, or like if you get nervous around going to the mall or being around people, it may also be an imbalance of niacin and magnesium. I think science is going to prove that there's some kind of deficiency that is allowing the mutation to occur, as we've seen with mycotoxins and molds, as with radioactive and chemicals, those three environmental factors, radiation, chemical, and mold, fungi, or mycotoxins, are the fastest to make a mutation. But there might be some interlink that way.
Oh, yeah. They have identified maybe, you know, 1,000 or more what they call DNA markers. And each one of these they've gone ahead and associated with some form of cancer, maybe cardiovascular disease, maybe diabetes. But the thing is that most of these associations are strictly a statistical comparison. They've not been clinically proven. And so the data that they need to establish any of these things are the things that take generational data to do. And so that's like, you know, 50 years worth of data that you need to go ahead and look at. And so the problem is they're going ahead and so there's this massive number of things that are still unknown.
Right.
And we even though we're going to study them for a while, Hildy, I don't think we'll, you know, we're going to want to go ahead and try to prove them.
Because right,
because it is this, and basically what I'm here to tell people is that it you don't have to, that this concept of epigenetics, it is an extremely complex process. It is the process that allows a butterfly that's crawling around prior to being a butterfly to go ahead and go into a cocoon and actually come out as a butterfly. And it has the same genes through this whole process, whether or not it's the caterpillar, whether or not it's the caterpillar in the cocoon, or whether or not it's the butterfly. And the understanding or the scientific description of how that all happens is this, in essence, theory, because it's very, very difficult to prove. And as I said earlier, Hildy's known me for quite some time here, and I've been involved in looking at things like this for a long period of time. And one of those things that I looked at is that I evaluated treatment by effectiveness, not by understanding. So when Dr. Christopher told me that I could go ahead and I should take this herb, and then this herb would go ahead and help me, I didn't have to understand how my digestion was going to take and use that herb, or how it was going to go into my bloodstream and maybe go ahead and support something in my system. I could look at the end fact that, hey, my cold got better.
Right,
or
right.
This happened or this happened.
Your
That's
symptoms
the part
change.
Of epigenetics
yeah.
that I'm interested in. I'm interested in the practical thing that it can do, because It validates our understanding that what we're doing is right. That if we go ahead and we can monitor what's going on, we now can go ahead and say that before we would just say, oh, well, you have someone that goes ahead and they have an illness. And then they go ahead and they may do herbs, they may do drugs, pharmaceuticals, they may do some type of energy treatment. They may even do this group prayer. But this person recovers. That is because that cellular environment of that cell was influenced by the action. And we don't have to understand how, but we can monitor and see the change.
Right, and you were instrumental in looking at these tests and, as I call it, creating this longevity test. Can you explain that to the audience? Which this is, to me, a really simple test and a very good guidance to showing whatever you're doing, even if you're eating a ham sandwich, if it's good for you or not good for you. You know, meaning if you're absorbing those nutrients, it will be reflective in this type of test. Could you explain that to the audience, please, George?
Yeah, when I graduated as a chemist, I got involved in a laboratory that was doing early disease detection. And basically what they were doing is they were doing what's called electrophoresis, which is separating blood into its different components and looking at them. And then they would go ahead and they would also, as you said, they would stain. And what they would do is they would go ahead and, because you would have some that were proteins, you'd have some that were, say, cholesterol or lipoproteins, and you have others that were enzymes. And you could go ahead and you could separate and look at each of those. And what you discover is that what nature is actually diversified. Some people will go ahead and say that cancer is a lower state of energy and that health is a higher state of energy. And they're looking at it from a state of complexity. And the reverse is true, that when a person has cancer, their system is no longer making, via that genetic trait, no longer making the diversified products that it was before. And what happens is you go ahead and you have it going ahead, and instead, because of the energy that goes into it, it's going ahead and it's reduplicating and making the same thing over and over again. And so when we would go ahead and even with the technology that we had back then, when you would look at this, and you would go ahead and you would see this, I don't know what you call it. I guess you would call it a spike. Now, if you've ever seen an EKG tracing or any kind of little tracing that went ahead and showed you how there are little peaks that go along. And as you're going along, and it just has all these little peaks, and then you go ahead and you see there's this big spike. And then it goes ahead and it goes back and goes along. What we would see is we would see those spikes in no matter what way we were looking at the blood. And then you would understand that wherever that spike was, that's an abnormality. What we've done now is we've gone ahead and this updated all of the technology so that we can use the computers and we can use digital imaging and we can use all of the current tools, but we're still looking at the exact same thing. We're looking for abnormalities and we're looking for shifts. And as I said, that the test for breast cancer that mm-hmm. they developed in the 70s, it went ahead and it did that type of tracing. It went ahead and basically showed that as this little tracing went ahead, and if it was like a curve, you'd go ahead and see it go ahead and shift its intensity from one side to the other.
Right, and we're going to pick up on the second hour, George, with that thought and bring you right back to it. Audience, we're taking a little break, approximately 1 minute to two, and we're going to join you on the second hour of One Cell, One Light Radio Show. audience, welcome back to our second hour with my special guest, Mr. George Morris, and we're talking about epigenetics. I like that word. I like making E's, so it's a nice word for me. And we were talking about longevity testing and just testing as a whole just before we left the first half. And, George, you were years ago, in 2003, there was an article by Mary Densworth in the New York Times quoting a JAMA report of the Journal of American Medical Association, which a study was done by Dr. Nir Brazali in Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, in reference to, and you've always taught me this and always stressed this with me, that the size of the cholesterol-carrying molecules is very important. The good cholesterol versus the bad cholesterol. And I'm always saying, well, cholesterol comes out of the liver when there's some toxin there because the cholesterol and the triglycerides are trying to wall it in and neutralize it. But could you explain to the audience, from picking up from the first hour where we were talking about particle size and you were talking about the peaks, to see the changes? But in particular, you've done a lot of work with particle size for cholesterol and showing as a monitoring tool for the effectiveness of whatever the treatment would be or supplements or medications that you may be on. Could you share with the audience about that work?
Yeah, I can. I just want to go ahead and remind the audience that our goal here is not to talk about science, but to somehow instill into you an understanding that you have choices, that science is here, and science can go ahead and it can try to understand what it's doing, but you, as the individual, are the one that's responsible for going ahead and doing what you can in your own life. And as Dr. Hilde was saying, I did quite a bit of research on what's called small, dense LDL. And basically, it is saying that all low-density lipoprotein, that called bad cholesterol, LDL, it's not all bad. As we were saying about that continuum of particles that that you can separate using electrophoresis, that continuum of particles is based on a combination of size and charge. And it will go ahead and it will separate out, and believe it or not, if the size of those LDL particles are bigger, they're able to go ahead and, in essence, transport more cholesterol. They're also more difficult to go ahead and get into your blood vessels and to cause the inflammation and the problem of cardiovascular disease. Whereas if the size of those particles continually gets smaller and smaller and smaller, for every single particle, it can carry less cholesterol, has less ability to go ahead and be able to go ahead and help remove or bad components from your blood.
Right, because it has less surface area, because there's smaller particles versus the bigger particles has a larger surface area.
Yeah, you've got
to attach to it,
the receptors that are on it and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. A charge. And as we know, you know, I'll just use an example. Say it was heavy metals. They might have a positive 2 charge or a negative 3 charge or whatever it may be. And it may be it would possibly be attracted to that surface area. So the larger the molecule of LDL, would be better. Is that correct, George?
Using that analogy, yes.
Yeah.
And so I like the easier analogy of the saying that the smaller it is, the easier it is to get into your blood vessel. And if and theoretically, if it's going to get into your blood vessel, then that's bad.
Right.
But there are a lot of other factors that do affect it. And then what they've done is they've gone, and they don't, believe it or not, they have studied cholesterol and this stuff for the longest period of time. and yet they still, you know, don't really understand what is the reason that things change.
Right.
And they right now we have maybe about 4 major clinical tests that are used. They can't use the same standard. Let's just say they can't take the same patient that happens to have a cardiovascular problem and test them on all 4 systems and get the same answer. Because each system is looking at a different endpoint, a different way that the disease is expressing itself. They all call it the same thing, but they can't go ahead and get the same answer. And so we've tried to get them to go ahead and have a universal standard, but none of the companies want to go ahead and do it. And so the government, you know, doesn't do anything. So what you have is such a simple thing that everybody thinks is very well understood, actually is still very misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still the complexity of cardiovascular disease and what actually causes it and what causes you to have the vulnerable plaque or to causes you to, you know, to have the heart attack or causes any of these things. There are theories, but in order to prove theories, it takes many, many years of actual study. And the problem is that as we gain more scientific understanding and we gain greater ability to go ahead and measure and look at things, that now becomes your starting point for developing more data. And we haven't had enough time to try to, you know, to sort these things out.
Right, and even not only just sorting them out, but even having, like, even on the genetics testing, now we're looking at thousands of DNA markers, you know, but that geneticists have done as SNPs or any of these types of technologies so that you can look at a certain group of genes and categorize it into the different diseases or any of that thing. The thing is that we don't even have the databases of one database talking to the other database to show it, like we do in a laboratory where we have different equipment talking to each other, which we call the LIM system, and just correlating all that data for the bigger picture. And I feel that is needed too.
Science progresses. It's needed. The thing that's needed the most is time, and the thing that patients and people that want to have some kind of modification in their life, what they don't have an excess of is time.
That's true.
And so you're working against 2 different principles here, unfortunately. You've got science that says that we need time in order to try to understand and validate what it is that we're talking about. And then you've got the patient there that's saying that, hey, I want something. I want to know that I have something. I've got a choice. That I have something better. And so that's what I've, you know, as I said, I've been looking at this for, you know, a very long time. And with those experiences, Dr. Christopher and other people that I met back in the early 70s, I saw a lot about how herbs, how energy, how homeopathics, how all of these things had an ability to affect change. But science at that point had 0 ability to monitor the change. And so you had to go ahead and accept the change because of the personal experience that you had of saying that it worked. And science doesn't like that. Science likes to go ahead and say, this half of my life, which is the clinical lab side, says that you need to be able to understand and see what's going on. And so for these past, you know, 30 years, I basically tried to go ahead and take and find a way that I could use science to be able to validate the things that I knew to be true from personal experience. And now that we have this new or improved understanding that epigenetics is giving us, it goes ahead and makes it so that we can go ahead and basically look at things. And it's like you have this researcher at Baylor University. Mm-hmm. And in 2011, he basically said that less than 5% of cancer arises from damaged genes. The vast majority is due to epigenetic influences.
Meaning other factors.
Yep. So now patients can look at herbs, they can look at nutrition, they can look at energetic interventions, they can look at options. Because what you want to do is you want to be able to influence that environment of that cell via some type of intervention, and that change in that environment can go ahead and make an influence on that cell that will get rid of your cancer.
Right, and I've always looked at a cell death and cell dysfunction and, you know, regeneration, but really, you shared with me a term which I thought was just a wonderful way of putting this, is that through these types of tests and looking at the epigenesis of it, you can reinstore cellular restoration, the process of it, by using these monitoring tools of epigenetic biochemical changes, even like what you showed with larger molecules of LDL versus the smaller molecules, monitoring a change so that you can see the effective result.
The thing is that if you end up having, for one reason or another, from your environment, or who knows, the reasons are unknown at this point, so you can just say that whatever reason you want. But let's just say that you've got small LDL, and then you go ahead and you read the most recent scientific literature or something in the health food store or wherever, and it goes ahead and says, hey, if you go ahead and take 2 grams of fish oil a day, and you take your coenzyme Q10 and your B vitamins, you'll be fine. Now, you're 20 years old at this point, and so you go ahead and you start doing that. And at 40, you have a heart attack. Now, why? Because for you, that wasn't the right thing to do. You have to understand what is right for you, not what's theoretically correct, but
what
actually works for you.
Or what's just in one book may not be good for you. You may need a collection of 10 books of knowledge in herbs or whatever the topic is.
Right.
To address
they may
what's
have had
in you.
To go ahead and add some B12 because they had some homocysteine that they needed to get rid of.
Yeah.
And they didn't get rid of the homocysteine, and so they ended up having the heart attack no matter what the other things that they did. And so when you would go ahead and if you could do a particle size test with small dense LDL, what you're looking at is you're looking at the end result of all of the metabolic processes. And so it doesn't matter what is the source of the metabolic process, you're looking at the end result. And so if the end result says, hey, my particles are getting bigger because of what I'm doing, then you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if your particles are staying the same, what you're doing isn't doing you any good. If they're getting smaller, you know you're not doing yourself any good.
Right, and a beautiful picture of this, and we put this on the website, and you shared it with us. The prime example is we all admire butterflies, but it starts out as a caterpillar, goes into a cocoon, has metamorphosis, meaning enzymatic metabolic changes, and it comes out this most gorgeous butterfly. Each of those stages of the development of the butterfly are different characteristics, different shapes, different cells, you know, meaning from a powdery feather, you know, not feathers, but powdery wings of a butterfly versus, skin of a caterpillar, you know, with many legs or little legs.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing how sound and light makes those enzymes and changes the shape and makes a chimpanzee and a frog and a human and a butterfly, but I've always been at awe of nature. I think it's the most beautiful being that way.
It's hard to believe that it took the year 2000 before scientists started to believe that epigenetics had some kind of real influence instead of genetics, when you could see all of these things in nature, and then what they would go ahead and basically say is they have an effect on that, but not on us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tried to go ahead and basically separate out humans from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, or fortunately, we're not. The same things that apply to nature, to other animals, really apply to us.
Yes.
And unfortunately, because that's not a politically correct thing to believe, many things have been completely misunderstood and are still completely misunderstood, only because they don't take that into effect when they go ahead and make their determinations and understandings of what's going on. Because science has said that no, we can't go ahead and accept that there are things that epigenetics has an effect. And so if this took all this time to get to a point where they're even going ahead and willing to accept it. And so part of it is the fact that they've lost so much money. The
right.
Life science groups all thought that with that development of the expression of the human genome and going ahead and saying that, hey, now we know how to make things, that they would be able to go ahead and create all of these wondrous drugs that would make them all this massive amount of money, because they would be able to go ahead and cure all these diseases.
Right. And
yet
even,
they have not been able to do it.
Right. Even the artificial biology of it, certain cells to grow certain things or clone it, it still doesn't come out as perfectly true as the original source. A copy is a copy is a copy. And taking, you know, the epigeneticist for the individual, can you share with the audience some ideas on how to do a prevention or cure of whatever they may be going through or treatment so that they take responsibility of their own epigeneticist approach to it?
As a disclaimer, you know, I'm a chemist.
Yeah, we're not.
I'm not a health professional. I don't provide anyone with any kind of health advice. Okay, what I do is I have a research laboratory, and within my research laboratory, I try to go ahead and help people understand what is the status of their health. And because I'm under all of these regulations by the federal government and state governments,
mm-hmm.
It's like I can run a test, I can know what the answers, what the test tells me.
Right,
but
the black and white
you,
of the result.
I can't tell you what it says.
Right.
Because of the restrictions that I'm on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I've done is I've been able to go ahead and work at one way around this problem. And that is that I get away from this whole concept of talking about disease, telling you what to do about your health or anything else, because what I'm talking about is a shift in basically this epigenetic modification that we're looking at here. And we're not looking at and so we're not linking it to disease, because we're not providing any kind of yardstick that comes back to go ahead and say that this is a disease state and this is not. But what we can do is we can go ahead and let you know what. Think of health as a continuum, and you're just on this road, and you start off the road at perfect health, and you end the road at death. And what we can do is we can help you understand where you are on that road. So if we go ahead and we take one test and it goes ahead and creates this baseline information, you can go ahead and you can do whatever type of intervention that is that you're doing. It doesn't matter what it is. If that intervention is going ahead and changing you, then when we go ahead and we do a second test, we can see whether or not that change is in the direction of wellness or not. And so, but again, those tests, we have to go ahead and basically, comply with a lot of rules.
Right, and so, on the biological test and everything.
Yeah.
I don't want to, misconstrue the audience or anything.
It's a basic blood test.
Right, but at the same time, not only a blood test or outlining the right influence, as we put it under the umbrella of epigenetic influences, it might be mango. Who knows what it may be. Because I think your ultimate goal, too, George, and you share this with me, is that the individual, are not necessarily destined to develop the diseases of your ancestors if you make the change, you make that shift.
Right, and I try to stay far away from going ahead and getting into treatment type of recommendations of any way, shape, or form, but the idea is that people need to understand where they are, where they're trying to go, and are they getting there? You can't just go ahead and live your life in the hopes that you're going to be healthy. It doesn't work that way. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of understanding that whether or not you go ahead and take a whole bunch of vitamins and then you go ahead and smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day, you may still have a problem. You have to go ahead and take real responsibility for your health. And there's no one out there that has anywhere near as much interest in your health as you should.
Right. You should take, meaning the individual should take responsibility of their own health.
And what this is doing is it's basically saying that science is saying that works. What this monitoring of epigenetic biochemical changes does is it allows us to go ahead and give you concrete information of whether or not what you're doing is accomplishing that goal that you want.
Right, and it's not only for the medication, the drug, the herb, or even like if you were practicing yoga or even group prayer. We've seen a lot of interaction or intervention, with prayer, and they've done a lot of studies on that. But that's the shift of the energy, too. The thing is that this allows as a tool to make sure it's doing well for you. I've also always said this, and I think you agree with me on this, George, is that if it's working, you're going to look good and feel good.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, I've had a lot of experience through the years, and one of the things, you know, you do is maybe you've tried traditional Chinese medicine. Maybe you've actually found yourself an expert healer. And now you go to that healer and when you need help. And what they're going to do? They're going to do these observations. They're going to go ahead and check your pulse. They're going to maybe look at your tongue. They're going to look at your eyes. They may look at your hands. But, and then they may give you really, really good advice. The problem is that we have a very, very insufficient number of those healers. And so we have to use technology to help us understand the same thing. Are we able to go ahead and interact in some way to restore balance back to this person? Is that process that we're doing working? Now, I happen to have one of those really good traditional healers. But... through the years, I've gone to many, 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 many people that I don't believe measure up.
Right.
And so
to the
you
quality
should not,
that
you should, you, right, quality wise, you should not limit your ability to control your health because you haven't been able to find a good healer.
Right.
You need to find ways where you can take that responsibility. You can go ahead and say, hey, I believe this. As she said, she had asked me, you know, a couple of times to go ahead and be here, and I can tell you that this is not my preferred thing to do. And probably in these 15 years, I maybe talked to a group of maybe 10 people or something like that. So it's fortunately I'm just talking to her. But the idea is that I have talked to everybody else. I mean, everybody. And they are so entrenched into the status quo that I need help. I need to find ways to reach people because it's only going to be people that want the change. It's only
right.
going to be people that want to get better. The government and the biotech industry, the physician industry, healthcare industry, this $1.4 trillion industry doesn't even believe that prevention is of value. Because when they go ahead and they look at the budget for Congress, they go ahead and they don't provide any benefit to going ahead and spending money on prevention of disease.
Yeah.
So with the comparative effectiveness research money, it all went toward secondary prevention. It didn't go toward primary prevention. It didn't go toward helping people stay healthy so that they wouldn't be diseased and wouldn't need all these massive, unrealistic treatments. It all went toward the status quo. And you might say 15 years and you haven't had people go ahead and believe you? Well, you've been talking to those people and you express an attitude like that and you wonder why. I do understand why, that through the years it is very clear that the people would much rather go ahead and do the status quo where they know where everything is happening
than
to go ahead and say, hey, why don't we go ahead and do this type of test? It gives us a really, really good answer. We're going to have to do a lot of work in order to get insurance to go ahead and pay for it. We no longer need to do these other 6 tests that we've been doing that we've been getting paid for. And by the time that gets from the researchers in the lab that go ahead and say, hey, this sounds like a really good idea. So the time it gets up to management, they don't call you back.
Right, and I'll give a little example of this, just meaning as a simple test that could be done. Because out here in California, as we're used to be in the Miami area, George, as with states that used gas lines, you know, meaning have gas plumbed into through their home for heating, meaning heating of the wall units or of the house, or in particular the stove. Out here, the thing is that you get exposed to carbon monoxide. Sometimes these lines have leaks in them, and individuals get exposed to it and have classical carbon monoxide poisoning symptoms. But I'm amazed that some of the emergency rooms do the test for carbon monoxide, not on the initial patient when it comes in to show, oh, whatever your level was, what you had in your home, they give it to you an hour after they gave you two bottles of oxygen to breathe. And I'm going, and you're still high, but they at least took the test. But what was it in the beginning? Because you got all these central nervous system disorders, and I'm just amazed. You know, if you've still got what I've had over the last 32 years in talks and IH is that, and you've seen it too, coming from the environmental, that if you have the symptoms of the toxin, meaning in particular the chemical, why don't you look for the chemical to see if it's at least in the blood or urine? Then we know it's circulating in the organ systems and doing something. As you brought out so beautifully in the first half and on the beginning of this second hour, the particle size and the charge. We know that some of these chemicals that you and I've dealt with over our lifetime are electrophilic, neutrophilic, meaning they have an anion, cation, they have a charge on them. So some of these materials, these chemicals, love to attach to certain electrically charged organ cells, like nerves, heart, or any of these things. But I'm just amazed. It goes back to years ago when my mentor, Dr. Lauren Hatch, he's passed away, was phenomenal on loan from NIOSH to start up the public health program through the universities in the South. The hardest thing is they never even had a toxicology course, a lot of physicians in the medical school. As with a lot of us, we didn't have the nano, but we were trained to at least go to the library and look it up. Right, George? We'll know it because that's what we do. We enjoyed reading books and training ourselves as we go along, you know? That's what books are for.
Yeah, now what we're trying to do is we're trying to go ahead and expand this kind of training and try to expand this level of consciousness. And we're, you know, this is my first foray into, this type of social media.
Right, to bring it forward,
I'm trying
and
to
I
find
appreciate
a way
that.
To go ahead and, you know, encourage people to be active, not to be passive, to go ahead and understand that, you know, people have, you know, you're passive when you don't have information. Once you have information, now it's your choice.
Right.
It's your choice to go ahead and either go ahead and modify and try to improve your life, or to go ahead and say, oh, well, that doesn't matter. That doesn't apply to me.
Right, because you want the true healing of yourself or the true beauty. From that healing, you have the beauty. You know, it's very important, I feel, you know, of whatever your ancestors were involved with, meaning either the hates, the loves, any of it affects all of you, meaning in those bloodlines or in that clan of 60 people or friends that you know. It all has a resonance to it, wouldn't you think, George, from what we've known on epigenesis?
That's the part that, you know, it takes generations to prove.
Right, right.
You can have a theoretical assumption and belief, you know, in something, but you know, that's the type of thing that, you know, that is very, very difficult to prove by science. So you may go ahead and do some meditation and say, hey, that seems pretty good to me. But it is really, really difficult to prove.
Right.
Now, but what we do know is that the environment has an enormous impact on disease, and that if we go ahead and just ignore the excess of 1,000 new chemicals per year that get produced and get put into it, and don't somehow try to hold someone accountable for the fact that it's like global warming, okay? Someone has got to change in order for that process to go ahead and change.
Right.
In order for that toxicity that is continually growing and developing in our environment to change, we have to go ahead and get these people that are producing these things, whether or not it's by intention or, like Fukushima, by non-intention, going ahead and putting things into our environment that have this ability to go ahead and change the environment of ourselves, therefore to be able to go ahead and change our health.
I'm gonna bring out something, because you mentioned Fukushima, which we know of the disaster in Japan, and the radiation exposures, et cetera. But also there was the development using the Chernobyl genes, meaning of individuals that were exposed to radiation during the time of Chernobyl. It was done at the Belarus Institute, where they were looking at making a vaccine against radiation for exposures using gene therapy. What do you think of that? I mean, just that whole concept.
I don't think it'll work.
I don't think they had much
success in going ahead and healing disease with gene therapy. I don't think they're going to have any success in going ahead and creating a vaccine to radiation.
Right, because everyone's looking at the primary genes of whatever the mutation is, not taking in consideration all of the junk DNA, which may be not only reflections of your divinities and everything, but also of the mutations, the enzymatic or the chemicals that you were exposed to. That look at what happened to Rasputin, meaning he was poisoned so many times with cyanide and everything, so the doses kept going up of his exposure. And the thing is, meaning chemically there was a lot of changes going on in that body, but no one's taken into account even your ancestral, what they worked with and were exposed to, and those types of natures that way.
We've gone ahead and when we look at health. Basically, I look at it as two things. You've got those two concepts that I put forth. One is that you see what works because you've experienced it in yourself, or you've experienced it with a loved one, or you experienced it through something that you learned or were trained. But it's something that you actually feel, works.
Right.
And then you have another whole side there of things that you through logic understand should work. And so much of what we can put forth is based on this logic that we understand the different steps that can take place. We go ahead and we understand with science what should work. And so with epigenetics, that's where we were for, probably going back to the 1930s, 1940s, people started thinking about it, 1950s. You even have people in the 1990s testing herbs to try to determine whether or not they actually had an epigenetic effect. And then you've had an explosion of people testing herbs since the 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, the reason they're going ahead and testing them is because they've discovered when they looked at healing and health that if they only looked at what they claimed to be was that antioxidant capacity of,
right.
say, of an herb, let's say cumin, they would go ahead and say that the amount of disease improvement cannot be compared only to the effect of that antioxidant capacity change. And so there's so you have this large improvement, and then you have only about maybe 10% of it that looks like it's actually due to antioxidant.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this 90% of the improvement in health, and they say, what caused it? And there were some wise people that basically said, hey, that must be that epigenetic effect. And so you just have more and more and more and more science looking at more and more and more things to understand, are those initial effects that we thought of being good, whether or not it's a resveratrol or whether or not it's garlic or doesn't matter, what it is, but we have this long history of it being claimed to be good, and yet we really didn't understand why it was good. And so we, as long as we only claimed it to be an antioxidant change, this antioxidant capacity, this ability to get rid of free radicals, instead of promoting the herb to get rid of the free radicals, they could go ahead and they could promote the drugs. And so they could go ahead and say, hey, we've got this drug that's going to do the same thing that the herb is going to do, and therefore now the drug is just as good as the herb.
Right.
But now that we've gone ahead and they've understood that beneficial effect was actually only a small part of what that drug is doing, because that drug isn't providing that change in cellular environment that's actually needed. It's just doing this little thing here off to the side. Now what you have is you have all these people researching all of these products, all these herbs, trying to understand what it is that they can mimic, and what is that cascade of events that is happening because that herb is there. And so now I'm on the backup documentation, I have a couple of things there. And basically, one of them goes ahead and it shows a natural product, and then it goes ahead and it shows this modification of this natural product, because now what they did is they discovered something that was in that chain of events of how that natural product was being used within the body that they were able to synthesize. And so now they went ahead and they synthesized this. Think of a river, and it's like something that was down the river, farther down going toward the treatment side, and not up the river toward the health side. They went ahead and they were able to synthesize it, and then they have a price tag of $64 million a pound. Instead of going ahead and saying, hey, why don't we really encourage people to go ahead and use the herb that we're trying to go ahead and mimic?
Right, instead of paying $64 million.
And so that's where the profit in the healthcare system has gone completely haywire.
Yeah. And the driving force is, I'm going to say, the ego of those corporations are that, and the intent of it is more, 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 want more, more, more. It's geld, 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 money, money, money. And it is an expense sometimes to find pure raw materials, meaning what I'm talking about is raw materials in its natural form, or the purest of the herbal blend that you may use in your formulations or anything. But I will say, when you experience having good herbals or good skincare products or anything that has the life force of those plants in it, your body just absorbs it like anything. It's hungry for it, and you see the difference in your body. And it would be ideal if these bodies that show the change, had tests like what you've developed, George, over the years, and looking at ways to measure it, for the effective change. I know I've done it for years on just simple questionnaires. Years ago, I used to do with Von Steely clinical epidemiology analysis showing the effects of premature aging as a result of exposures. And now they've made computer softwares of those. So I think it's interesting. 20 years ago, they didn't have it. And I remember Mrs. Von Steely, golly, I got to use all this data, to compute. That's when we all remembered how to do statistics, But that's a long time ago, George, long time ago.
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking here as an example, maybe to help people understand the difference in herbs.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I have a really, really good Chinese herbalist and Qigong master that basically, has taught me some information. And one of the things that she taught me is that when you look at an herb like ginseng, and you go ahead and you see that you've got, you can go ahead and you can buy this, ounce of it here for like $10, or you can go ahead and get this other product here, and it might cost you $50. And lo and behold, there's this other product over here. It might cost you $200. And you would go ahead and say, well, they're all 1 ounce of the same thing. And what she tried to get me to understand is that they're not the same. And in essence, what it is that if you look at the components, the beneficial components that are in the ginseng, the more expensive the ginseng is, the more beneficial components that it has within it. And so, depending on what it is that you're using it for, so let's say you're using it because you want to really help, support your body, and you're suffering from cancer. You're going to want to go ahead and use a product that has the capability of interacting with the largest number of abnormalities as possible. Because these abnormalities do not exist as massive numbers of things, but because they exist, they go ahead and they convert and they convert and they convert and they convert. And so what you want to do is you actually need to go ahead and take this product that's got the greatest number of supporting components in it, even if you can only afford to go ahead and take 1/10 of the amount of this product over here that was 1/10 the price, because it's still going to go ahead and provide you with more benefit because it can interact with more adverse things.
Right, and what I was going to add is that in Korea, it's tradition for them that as you go up in age, maybe you're 30 or 40, and you get a ginseng, I assume it's Korean ginseng, that is the same age as you are. you know, like if you're 30 years old, it's a 30-year ginseng plant, and you're to eat the root of that. And those are thousands of dollars when you're looking at one that is specifically your age, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just adding to that, because maybe it has the beneficial components, like you're saying.
Oh, I was just wondering, Hildy, do we have any call-in questions?
I don't know. We're coming up onto the hour of the show, audience, and if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Mr. Morris or myself, please feel free to call in, and I'll give our number, which is 602-753-1636. And we'll be happy to take the question and answer it for you to the best of our ability. Right, George?
We'll try. So just to reiterate, basically the testing that I'm talking about, it goes ahead and it does have the capability to monitor a return to wellness within days to weeks of starting an intervention. And the testing is done on a standard blood sample. And so if you're in a state that does require a physician request to get that blood sample, you would have to provide that. And then that would be a capability of getting something like that. And the other thing that I really want to remind people of is the fact that, you know, even if you go ahead and you believe that you've got your 120 natural years allotted to you, it's like for you to be able to live them, you have to work at it. You have to understand that you want to make it there.
Right.
And it's going to be your effort that does it.
And, George, I just got a note from our program director that you and I didn't realize that we're coming so close to the hour. We only have about 3 or 4 minutes left of the show, so we might not get the call-ins. But, audience, if you have any specific questions, please direct them to our One Cell, One Light, I think it's at Gmail, email, and we'll make sure that we get them to George, and we'll get those answered for you if you do have any questions. And in summary, because one is we're coming at the end of the year and we're on this special day of an eclipse over a black hole, and the thing is that in just even the last 50 years of looking at the many changes and the uses of science, and that we still have an increase in diseases, but I feel through the intervention of tests that you've developed and science and just individuals taking on the responsibility of their own health and beauty that way, and also audience, we've emphasized health because that's a passion with George and I, but the thing is that you can use these same tools and tests to look at to see if the products that you're using to make yourself beautiful, skincare products or anything, are doing the work too. Wouldn't you think so, George?
It would be limited to figure out. It has to be something that we're looking at that would have a real systemic effect.
Yes.
For most of the testing that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, you know, there are ways to look at it. But I just want to reiterate that, you know, it is going to be, you know, their effort to go ahead and you know, why I'm here is to go ahead and see if I can't find some people maybe that want to help, that feel like they either want to go ahead and be active with their own life and that we can somehow help them, or they would like to go ahead and just be able to help initiate change. I mean, there's all sorts of change that needs to happen because, as we said, these are things that are in our environment. I support like the Environmental Research Council, you know, various things out there that, you know, And Hildy is involved in various things that where we're looking at new potentially adverse things that are happening in the environment and because that environment goes ahead and impresses its opinion, its feeling, its negativity on us. And
mm-hmm.
that goes ahead, and then that affects ourselves, that affects how we live, that affects our health, and it can affect our and not, you have to understand that all the, all changes that are epigenetic are not negative. People that go ahead and bring joy in their life, that bring love in their life, that have commitment in their life, those are also positive things. And positive things can go ahead and affect yourselves just as much and hopefully more the negative things. And so when people go ahead and they have spontaneous remission from disease, it is generally because of the fact that they have had a lot of positive in their life.
That's very true. Positive support during those times.
Yep. And they didn't, without epigenetics, they didn't have a way to understand why that had an effect. And it's like Qigong, Tai Chi, these types of energy things, they have an effect to go ahead and change that energy environment that also is around that cell. And
yes.
So it's prayer changes that energy environment that's around that cell. And therefore, the cell then responds to that environment that it's now engulfed in. So it's just so critical, no matter what level of health that you have, that you understand that you need to go ahead and be continually seeking better health. Doesn't matter where you are, that you just always want to have that positive attitude that you want something better.
Yeah, that's
so,
it. And you have to have that attitude. You could have everything negative around you, but doesn't mean that you are. You have to go higher, right, George?
Yeah. You have to understand that, hey, you got life. You are alive. You have to be happy.
Right. And if you don't have happiness, just get some lemon drop and put it in your life, and you'll put a smile on your face. I want to thank you, George, for being my special guest, and I wish you and your family a beautiful holiday season. And thank you all 120 countries that listen to us out there on One Cell, One Light Radio. God bless. Blessings to you and all your ancestors. Bye-bye.